Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Today on the program, Utah State University's Science Unwrapped guest speaker, USU physicist Jeff Hasbin, joins us to talk about his kayaking adventure in Russia's far eastern Kamchatka Peninsula, where he explored pristine and threatened salmon habitat. Jeff not only wanted to find new stretches of whitewater, he also wanted to learn more about the imperiled salmon population in this region. He combined his sense of adventure with science and collected water samples along his journey for scientists to analyze, and he researched what effects human populations in the area were having on the decline of the fish. A National Geographic film crew went along for much of the ride with Jeff and a few of his friends. They filmed them for a segment of their TV series called Monster Fish that aired in July 2011. Jeff is studying theoretical physics right now, but his college education started out in the field of wildlife biology.
I spent a couple of seasons in the High Sierra in Nevada doing surveys for endangered frog species. And that's most of my experience. I also worked with desert tortoises in Nevada for a little while.
His concern for endangered species and desire to help them initially sparked his interest in wildlife biology.
And anything that was very rare and interesting, and I loved being outside. So I've always had a passion for being outdoors, and so wildlife biology kind of mixed both of those interests really well.
Jeff grew up in upstate New York, where he says he spent a lot of time outside.
I spent a lot of time in a canoe in high school for a lot of years, and then in my undergrad, I spent a lot of time with the outing club that was associated with Syracuse University, and we went up to the Adirondack Mountains almost every weekend.
When did you start kayaking and to learn how to kayak? And I know that is very can be very challenging, kayaking.
Sure. Like I said, I sort of self-taught myself to canoe when I was in high school. I was on the cross-country and track teams, and my friends and I decided to do a race, a triathlon race, where one of the legs was canoeing. And so me and a friend of mine sort of taught ourselves how to canoe and flipped the canoe in the middle of the lake and tried to figure out how to flip it back upright to get ready for the race. And we used to go out and practice a lot. But I didn't actually learn how to whitewater kayak until college. So my first year in my undergrad, I was involved with my outing club at Syracuse. And they had all of the boats and all of the ability, and the other students, the older students would teach the younger students how to do whatever it was that we were doing, whether it was kayaking or caving or rock climbing or anything like that. And I went to a session where they teach you how to roll, do an Eskimo roll, which is where you flip the kayak back upright in the pool. And I got hooked from that moment. I've definitely always been a water baby. I've spent a lot of time in the water. My mom would take me for swim lessons. I was always the last kid out. So I love being in the water. And there's something about kayaking where, unlike a lot of the other activities I've done, it always keeps my attention. You know, the river is always moving and the waves are always coming against you. And if you stop paying attention to the river, you flip over. So it's this really neat feedback loop where the river is always making you pay attention to it, which is...
And so what attracted you to the Kamchatka River in Russia? And how did that trip develop?
So the trip developed by a good friend of mine named Rob Bart. It was sort of his brainchild, and Jay Gifford, another person on the trip. And they live in Hood River in Oregon, and I was doing my master's degree at Oregon State. And I know them from kayaking there, and it was their brainchild to try and go to Kamchatka. We had always thrown it around as a place that had never really been explored by kayakers. There are a lot of places since the advent of Google Earth, a lot of kayakers get together, have a couple of beers, and search Google Earth for new places to go kayaking. And it's one of those places that's just been this black spot for a really long time. And so they decided they're going to do something about it, and they really wanted to go. So they came up with going to Kamchatka and then invited everyone to go. And they said, the first six people who get back to me will be on the trip. So.
And then what was the trip like getting there? It's quite remote.
Yeah, that's right. And the flights there are really interesting. So there used to be flights directly from Alaska to this part of Russia. It is in the far east of Russia, so it's basically right across the Bering Sea from Alaska. And those flights are only like 4-hour flights. Unfortunately, they get canceled pretty much for 2 years, and then they'll run for a year, and then it's obvious they're not making enough money, so they get canceled again. So we actually had to go the long way around the Earth. So we did 7/8 of the way around the Earth from Utah. So we flew to JFK, and then to Moscow, and then from Moscow to Petropavlovsk, which is the capital of Kamchatka. And the flight from Moscow to Petropavlovsk, which is all over Russia, was longer than the flight from JFK to Moscow.
Wow. Yeah. And what kind of plane was that?
They were all big planes. It was a big, the jet that was in Russia was just a big old jet that was, it had no baggage compartments above you. So it was almost twice as tall as a regular jetliner, which was really interesting. But so we landed in Russia and we were there for a month, and we were sort of based in the capital of Kamchatka, which is at the southern tip of the peninsula. But then we did a couple of trips from there. So we did two self-supported kayak expedition trips north of the city. And then we did a third trip with the camera crew to a different river called the Zhuponova River. And then we did a fourth trip to a preserve in the southern part of, even further south of the city of Petropavlovsk, called Kuril Lake. So we did four big trips. And for all of those trips, we had to take these really large old Soviet helicopters called Mi-8s, and big, noisy helicopters you could drive a Jeep into. And that's the only way to get to any of these places, because there's a couple of roads, one road that goes up the peninsula. But besides that, there's only roads around the capital. Everything else is really, really remote. And it's only about an hour, hour and a half by helicopter to the places we went to. But it would have taken us days to get there any other way. On the self-support trips with the kayaks, we have to fit all of our gear into the kayaks because that's all we can take down. So, in fact, you end up taking less gear on a kayak overnight trip than you do on a backpacking trip, because you couldn't imagine fitting a backpack, like a big backpack, overnight backpack, into the back of a kayak. So we can only fit so much in the back there. And when it was just us, it was pretty easy. We would just load up the back of the kayaks. The helicopter would come pick us up, and we'd just throw the kayaks in the back of the helicopter. And the helicopter lands really close to the river, and we just walk to the river and put on. The trip we did with the television crew was a good deal bit more difficult. We had three rafts and a couple of Russian guides, river guides with us, and a fly fishing guide, and four people with the production team and the host for the TV crew, and lots of boxes of gear as well. So in that case, the helicopter was pretty full. And though helicopters are supposed to take off by going straight up, we actually had to get a running start to take off with this load.
The idea to kayak this stretch of river attracted a lot of attention, National Geographic, scientists, and also the locals. But Hasbun notes their main objective was to give something back to the community.
So to be completely honest, our main objective for all of the kayakers to go was to go and explore the whitewater of this peninsula. That was the first thing we really wanted to do. But we've all done a lot of international traveling to go kayaking. And on this trip, we really had a desire to have a positive impact on the place we were visiting. So we tried to look into it and see what it is we could do and what we could say about Kamchatka and what are the issues that it has and what could we do. We wanted to leave the place better than we found it. And so we looked into a number of different things. We found out that there's a huge problem with salmon poaching on the peninsula, and that the salmon, though it's one of the last bastions of wild salmon in the world, the populations are starting to decline severely. And so we tried to figure out what we could do about that. And so we talked to a few scientists and conservationists, and I also talked to a hydrologist who told us a few samples that we could take while we were out there. You know, a lot of these studies, they take a long time, and so we would only be at one spot on the river for a very short amount of time. So there weren't too many things that we could do, but I did take water chemistry readings of the river on the rivers that we went down. And a couple of these rivers, you know, certainly no Western scientists had ever been on these rivers before. So the data is from a river that no scientists had ever really paid attention to. We also kept track of the species that we were finding. We did a little bit of fishing on these rivers. So we looked at what fish we caught, and I paid attention to the flow of the river. So we did a couple of measurements to see how much water was going down the river as well. And those are really just base measurements. And most of what was really helpful was for the hydrologist. And he's continuing to try and use that information to write up a couple of grants to go back there to do more comprehensive research, science-wise.
Could you describe what the area, what it looks like on your, you know, as you're flowing down the river in your kayak? What are you seeing, and what kind of wildlife was around you? And I understand there are lots of volcanoes too.
Yeah. So everywhere that we flew to in the helicopters, at some point we passed by enormous volcanoes. We had to go over a couple mountain ranges to get to the rivers we were going to, especially the first river, the Karamskaya. And there's a Karamskaya volcano that's just very close to the river. And it's just amazingly beautiful. It looks a lot like Mount Rainier that you would see in Seattle, just this big, beautiful, classic, you know, pyramid-looking volcano. This one actually smoking and sending off bursts of ash every couple of minutes. And so you would see this, snow-covered with ash flying out of the top of it. And then as you would move down, it looked a lot like Southeast Alaska, just like you'd see trees a little bit lower down and then a lot of brushy trees and just beautiful, beautiful landscape.
What were the dangers? I mean, other than riding in the helicopter and the dangers of just being in a river on a kayak and the white water, but I understand there were also lots of bear.
Yeah, that's right. So we would actually, on a couple of the rivers, we would get out to go scout a rapid or look at it. And on my first time getting out, I was like, there's a big trail here. It's like a 3-foot wide trail packed to the ground, to the dirt. And my friend was like, that's not a person trail, that's a bear trail. And so there are so many bears around there that they have these tracks kind of laid down through the woods. And there were a couple places where we saw bears from across the river, and it would these huge, huge Kamchatkan brown bears. And we were really worried about them initially. We took flares with us to try and scare them away, and trying to keep a flare waterproof that you buy in Russia, because, of course, you can't fly with flares. So we couldn't find waterproof flares once we got to Russia. So there's these paper flares that we're trying to keep dry as possible, but at the same time keep them somewhere where we can get to them really quickly. It was a big, big worry in case we were going to run into anything. But it really turned out that the bears were very afraid of us. Every time they saw us, they'd sort of sniff in the air and kind of take off in the other direction. Not in a hurry, mind you, but just start walking off in the other direction. And a lot of them had never really seen fire or anything like that. And we tried to keep our camps really clean and keep the food up so that they couldn't smell it. Thankfully, we mostly had dehydrated food, so it wasn't a very smelly endeavor. I definitely would not have been wanting to fry bacon out there.
How did it change your overall view of conservation and ways to go about it, and also just the situation of the salmon there and then salmon throughout the world?
That's a great question. The perils that the salmon have in the Kamchatka Peninsula are the same ones that they've had all over the rest of the world. They're starting to think about putting in dams, which are going to stop the salmon from going up the rivers. But the biggest thing is the poaching. And there are sort of mom-and-pop operations, and sort of everyone on the peninsula has grown up catching salmon. And there's an indigenous population there that are closely related to the Inuit. They all catch salmon in nets, and they're allowed to catch them in nets. The white settlers, the white folks there, the Russians, they're not allowed to catch salmon in nets, but they all do. They'll string these nets across the river. And, you know, they go out and they catch like 40 or 50 salmon just before they get to their spawning grounds. And so the salmon are about to lay their eggs, and they catch them to take their eggs. And that's a little bit of a problem, but the biggest problem are these industrial poachers. And a lot of them aren't actually from the peninsula. They come from Vladivostok, or they come from Japan or other places. And they go to the west side of the peninsula. They set off anchor on the shore, and they go in and they stretch chain link fence across the river and catch every fish that goes up for a 10-day period. And all they do is take the eggs. So they don't take the fish to eat the meat. All they're after is the eggs, because the caviar is worth so much money. And that's a real big problem, definitely a really big problem. But you look at the mom and pop folks, and they're just going out and sort of supplementing their living. And it's something they've done forever. And it's conservation issues are very complicated. If you're just looking at the species itself, you can usually figure out what you can do. But when you add the human factor in it, it's really difficult. These folks are very, very nice people. They have done this their whole lives. They've done it for generations. They've pulled these fish out of the rivers. And it's hard for them to see that it's a vanishing resource. They say, oh, the fish will come. You know, there's always fish. But they also know that there are less and less fish. So it's this sort of idea where they're just like, oh, this is just a small year. Tomorrow, you know, next year there'll be more fish. So that's, I think, my takeaway message was just how complicated the issues are and how much I think you don't want to go in there and tell them what they're doing wrong, because I don't even know what they're doing wrong. You know, the idea is that I was going there to learn. I wanted to come back and show people what a beautiful place this was, how many salmon there were, what it's like to be in a place where the river is just chock full of fish, like where you can walk across fish. And those are amazing, amazing things. And I think that it's just building perspective. You know, you show people in America what that's like, and then people in Russia sort of start to realize what it is that they really have, this beauty they have in this amazing place.
And how were you received by the locals there?
You know, we were received pretty well, actually. People were very, very happy to answer our questions. And we actually talked to a lot of people who were conservationists. There's a number of people in the different parks who go out and look for poachers. They're on anti-poaching patrols, and they showed us old poaching sites and things like that. But on the counter of that, we actually had a pair of mom and pop poachers ask us to come out with them. They wanted us to see what they were doing. And so they brought us out in little rafts in the river behind their house and sort of showed us what they were doing and how many fish they catch and which fish they keep and what they do with the fish after they're done. And they're not embarrassed. They don't really think they're doing anything wrong. They're just showing us how they live their life. It's a really neat place because it's one of the places in Russia where there are still a lot of native people as well. And so we also met natives to the peninsula who have, you know, traditionally been there for thousands of years catching salmon or herding reindeer. And then we met the Russian people who have been there for a really long time, and just the interplay between those two cultures. And it was a great place.
And do you know how much the oil and gas industry is impacting or threatening that area, that river?
That's a really important question. So there's a couple of things that are going in. There's a couple mines that are going in, and there's a pipeline on the west coast of the peninsula. And I'll talk a little bit about this in my talk on Friday, but basically there was a referendum to see whether the pipeline should go in or not, and ended up going in even though people voted it down. The pipeline comes along with the pipeline a road along the pipeline, and that's actually the biggest deal for the salmon of Kamchatka. Because every river in Kamchatka that has a road next to it has barely any salmon compared to the rivers that have no roads next to them, where the rivers are chock full of salmon, all kinds of salmon, all six species most of the time of salmon. And so the pipeline is actually just the fact that the road is coming in is the biggest detriment to the salmon. Once there's a road, it's easy to drive up, sling a net across the river, catch a ton of salmon, cut them all, you know, cut the caviar out of them, put them in buckets, and get out of there as quick as you can.
Jeff next describes what theoretical physics, wildlife biology, and kayaking all have in common.
All of those things connect for me in the idea of exploration. And that's the thing that's always been at the forefront of my mind. I love going out and finding new places. And so though physics seems quite different from kayaking, especially, being a theoretical physicist is being an explorer of sort of at the edge of what we understand about the universe. And that's what I enjoy about it the most. If we already knew it, I wouldn't like being there and trying to figure out the stuff that we're trying to figure out. So that's really what connects it for me, is it's all exploration.
Jeff Hasbin speaks at 7 in the Eccles Science Learning Center at USU tonight. If you attend, here's what you can expect to hear and see.
I'm going to summarize a little bit about what the goals of the trip were, and I'm going to show a lot of really pretty pictures. A few of the other kayakers on the trip are professional photographers, and we have some of the most beautiful wilderness and wildlife photos that I've ever seen. And so I'm going to show a lot of those really pretty pictures. I'm going to show a little bit of a snippet from the episode of Monster Fish that we helped to tape as well.
Sherry Quinn for Access Utah. Stay tuned for Science Questions up next.
when I'm alone, I'll be better off than I was before. I've got this life.
Support for Science Questions is provided by the College of Science at Utah State University, where graduates' acceptance rates to medical, dental, and graduate schools exceed national averages. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. More information at usu.edu/science.
On the next edition of the Putumayo World Music Hour,
it's music from parts of the world where French is spoken. North Africa, the Caribbean, Canada, and Brittany. I'm Dan Storper.
And I'm Rosalie Howard. Join us for Le Monde Français, the French world, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Support for Science Questions is also provided by Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
Welcome to Science Questions. This is Sherry Quinn. Great apes, humans' closest relatives, are nearing extinction. There are four kinds: gorillas, chimpanzees, and bonobos that live in Africa, and orangutans that subsist in Indonesia. Primatologist Craig Stanford says they all may become extinct within the next century.
Their total population, if you combine the remaining numbers of all four species, is only in the low hundreds of thousands. And so compared to 7 billion of us on the planet, that's a very scary low number. And a couple of those species, in particular, the bonobo and the orangutan, are really perilously close to the brink of extinction. And that's why I thought we needed to get the information out there to the public about exactly what's going on with them in terms of their extinction risk and also what efforts are being made to protect them.
Craig Stanford is professor of biological sciences and anthropology at the University of Southern California, where he also serves as co-director of the Jane Goodall Research Center. He has conducted numerous field studies throughout the world, including chimpanzee hunting behavior in Tanzania, in collaboration with Dr. Jane Goodall, of chimpanzees and mountain gorillas in Uganda, and of langur monkeys in South Asia. In addition, for the past several years, he has been involved in field research and conservation efforts on endangered tortoises. In fact, SQ Radio aired an interview with Stanford about his book titled The Last Tortoise in 2010. He feels especially partial to wild chimpanzees, and one in particular.
I feel incredibly privileged that I've been able to spend as much time as I have in forests in Africa and Asia, sitting in close company with wild animals, and in particular, wild chimpanzees in East Africa. And, you know, I've worked with a lot of wild chimps in terms of, is there an individual who strikes a chord with me? One of Jane Goodall's most famous chimps is a huge male named Frodo, who is a member of a famous long lineage of chimps that were descended from Flo, one of her original female chimps back in the 1960s. And Frodo is a big, macho male chimp who was a great hunter of monkeys, and I was studying monkey hunting back in the 90s. So I spent a lot of time with him. He was kind of fearsome, kind of neurotic, a little bit scary to be around sometimes, but a magnificent, brilliant, Machiavellian sort of animal. And I think to be in the close company of an animal like that, particularly in the wild, you know, in an African forest, where you can approach them and be accepted into their day-to-day life, is just an almost unspeakably wonderful privilege I feel I've gotten to enjoy in my life. And so you can't help but then want to give something back when you've had that experience.
Stanford has published 16 books and more than 100 scholarly and popular articles. He says most of the books he's written have been about the science of primate behavior and using what great apes do to understand human nature and human origins.
And after many years of doing research on that topic and writing many books and many articles, I decided I would write a book that was completely explicitly about conservation in order to try to raise consciousness, raise awareness of some of the really critical issues facing the remaining great apes.
His latest book, Planet Without Apes, is the story of a tragic extinction that Stanford urges us to stop. Of the four living great apes, orangutans are the most threatened to leave this earth first.
Well, each species has its own set of problems. But in general, if you looked at orangutans, which live in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, on the islands of Sumatra and Borneo, their biggest threat is deforestation. So the Indonesian government is in charge of a rapidly developing economy, and a lot of that economy revolves around exploiting the natural resources. That's understandable, but there's very little room left in their plan for development for the wildlife of Indonesia, and it's a very wildlife-rich country. So just rapid, large-scale clearing of the forest in order to create palm plantations to grow oil palms have just absolutely ravaged orangutan populations. There are some estimates that the orangutan population has dropped by 20 or 30% just in the last 6 or 8 years. So it's really in free fall.
The extinction risks to the great apes in Africa, the bonobo, chimpanzee, and gorilla, are different depending on where you look, but there are some commonalities.
One of the big threats facing African apes is the fact that people in Africa, in some parts of Africa, absolutely relish the meat of great apes. They treat the meat of great apes as a delicacy. They regard them in the same way that we regard lobster or caviar, and they're willing to pay, people who can afford to are willing to pay 5 or 10 times the price of beef to get a meal of smoked gorilla hands or chimp feet. And usually this is a meal that's used to impress your colleagues, your house guests, but is absolutely ravaging African ape populations. It's gone on for thousands of years. The eating of apes is something that people have done in Africa as a tradition for thousands of years, we think. And it probably never had a severe impact until recently, because recently it's become a commercialized industry with smuggling routes out of the African forest to go to towns, cities, and even ultimately on a global black market scale to Europe and perhaps even North America.
Another threat is the black market for bushmeat. It ends up in some of the world's most famous cities.
The scale of bushmeat smuggling globally is absolutely mind-boggling. And to be honest, great apes only represent a tiny slice of the overall bushmeat trade, the illegal trade. Most of it is the meat of antelopes, pigs, and assorted other African animals. But the problem the great apes have is that they reproduce very, very slowly. So their numbers just simply cannot sustain themselves. They can't even begin to sustain themselves in the face of this really highly developed, commercialized trade for bushmeat. And yes, Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris has had a smuggling bus, and the estimates are that maybe tens of tons of bushmeat are being smuggled through Charles de Gaulle Airport every year, and there have been busts in Brussels, London, basically any place where West and Central African people have migrated to and formed expat communities, there is a demand for bushmeat because it is culturally valued. And so there'll be restaurants and cafes that are illegally selling this meat out of the back room, and that drives the demand.
Stanford has worked in a lot of national parks in Africa that are safe havens for apes. But he adds it is important to look at them more closely before trusting they are legitimate.
Sometimes, depending on which one, they're well protected. They have, you know, armed guards. They have conservation programs with public outreach. They have tourist programs that are thriving. But many, many national parks in Africa or anywhere in the developing world often exist in name only. So if you opened an atlas and looked on a map of some countries, you'd see all of these big national parks indicated, sometimes hundreds of square miles. But very often, they're only on the map. If you actually go to that place, there are no fences, there are no guards, there's no entry point, and there simply is wanton, open poaching of wild animals and illegal cutting of the trees, simply because the governments involved just don't have the resources to create an infrastructure to protect these places, and they don't have an infrastructure that would support the tourist industry either.
According to Stanford, one of the biggest threats to protecting wildlife and natural ecosystems everywhere is political instability.
I mean, that's why the affluent democracies of the world, the European countries and North America and Australia, have the best national park system. Because in unstable places, those tend to be poor places. And as we know, civil wars and ethnic cleansing and genocide and a lot of awful stuff tends to happen, you know, almost entirely in the modern world in desperately poor places. And so in these desperately poor places, it's hard to set up and maintain a conservation program. It's hard to even know what's going on. And so many of these civil war-torn areas in Africa are kind of no man's land, where scientists cannot go safely, conservationists cannot go and do surveys safely. And then, of course, you can't set up a project that tourists are going to want to go to in the face of political instability.
In his field research in Africa, Asia, and Central and South America, Stanford has worked amidst political turmoil.
In the areas where I've worked primarily in my career, primarily East Africa, thankfully there is no real bushmeat trade. People don't really eat the meat of primates, monkeys or apes in those areas. It's mainly Western and Central Africa where that happens. However, Uganda, where I had a project for 10 years, has pockets of instability, and my own project was in the middle of a rebel militia attack in the late 90s that resulted in the kidnapping of a number of foreign tourists, eco-tourists who had gone to see the guerrillas. Some of those tourists were murdered by the rebels. And when you set up an ecotourism program and you use the revenue from it to support conservation and protection of animals like gorillas, that's a great plan. But if you're in a politically chaotic area, the minute there's an attack like this, of course, the whole thing falls apart. So for about a year, tourism just ended, and tourism is providing the economic incentive for local people to respect and protect the wildlife. So, yeah, there was kind of a wild ride there in some of the places that I've done my research.
American zoologist Diane Fossey became well known for her story told in the book Gorillas in the Mist that was later made into a film. She studied gorilla groups in Rwanda for 18 years and was mysteriously murdered in 1985. Stanford describes her influence in the study of gorillas, and he reveals surprising details about Fossey's field strategies.
She really broke new ground in immersing herself in the lives of mountain gorillas and showing the world that they were, in fact, gentle creatures whose main threat was from people and not the other way around. But at the same time, Diane Fossey was a kind of a troubled person, and she regarded her camp in Rwanda as her own kingdom, in a sense. And so, in fact, for many years, she ruled that area and protected it against poachers, mainly with the threat of a shotgun, shooting at poachers and acting like an armed guard. And in the end, that backfired in a big way. It didn't really stop the gorilla poaching. She eventually was murdered, we think, by an ex-employee or maybe a poacher. And then, ironically, immediately after her death, her former students approached the government of Rwanda, and they proposed a new path, which would involve tourism. Fossey had always ardently opposed ecotourists coming into her forest. The tourists would come, and the plan was they would pay money to see the gorillas, and a portion of that money would go toward national park conservation projects. And today, if you go to Diane Fossey's former forest station and her field project, you have one of the best-run and most successful ecotourism programs involving big animals anywhere in the world. And that money from that program is really helping give the government of Rwanda a true incentive now to protect mountain gorillas.
An unlikely culprit nearly all of us in America use every day is contributing to the decline of a population of gorillas in the Congo, Stanford explains.
Very few people realize that when they pull out their smartphone, they're using a device that contains a kind of an ore called coltan, which is a nickname for an ore called columbite tantalite. That is, it's an essential part of your iPhone or your smartphone because it allows these miniature devices to run without overheating. But at the same time, this ore mostly comes from forests in the Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, in which the last remaining populations of eastern lowland gorillas live. And about 80% of the world's coltan supply comes from that place. And so there is a major mining operation in those areas. It's sort of similar to the California Gold Rush in that it is a very destructive kind of mining that really devastates river streams and the forests surrounding them. The miners establish themselves in camps, and they end up hunting the gorillas for food while they're there. So it's had a devastating effect on eastern lowland gorilla populations, which have now dropped to just a few thousand. We really don't know for sure. So ironically, this high-tech product, which is mined in the Congo, then shipped to China, and then ends up in everybody's smartphone, is having a big impact back in the Congo on wild gorilla populations.
Tragic. I mean, here I'm on my cell phone, and you are too.
Right. There is no easy solution. Of course, we tell people to recycle their cell phones when they're done with them and not just toss them away. That maybe makes a dent in this problem. But, of course, it's a major problem given the popularity and the increasing use of these miniaturized devices throughout the world.
Another threat to the great apes are emerging viruses.
A lot of those diseases that Hollywood likes to turn into blockbuster movies like Ebola or anthrax, and which we think of some of them as being bioterror weapons or just, you know, scary, almost science fiction diseases, actually probably have had a much greater impact on great apes than they've ever had on humans. So we know that in the Republic of the Congo, there have been thousands of gorilla deaths and probably chimp deaths too, where carcasses have been found scattered across the rainforest floor, and they have been victims of Ebola. We don't really even know precisely the whole system of how Ebola works in terms of who all the vectors are, which animals are carriers, and what animals they pass it to. But we know that Ebola has been responsible for thousands of great ape deaths. Some estimates say as high as 5 to 10% of all the remaining gorillas in Africa have died over the past 10 or 15 years from Ebola. So that's just, you know, another. I know that these threats pile up and it seems like an insurmountable problem. I don't think it is insurmountable. I think we're passing through a bottleneck right now, and we need to get these animals and their habitats through the bottleneck. And hopefully by the mid to late 21st century, the populations will be in better shape, the world population will stabilize, and we'll have a better chance to preserve them long term.
In the 1950s, wild chimpanzees were brought to the U.S. for behavioral and biological testing. Even though we have since learned the genetic codes of chimps and humans are 99% similar, we still use them as guinea pigs.
I would like to be able to say that there is no research being done anywhere in the world on captive great apes because they are so similar to us that it just seems unthinkable we'd be using them as medical pincushions. There are about 1,500 chimpanzees in laboratories in the United States, biomedical facilities, and there are plans afoot to phase them out of research completely. Right now, there are relatively few being used actively in biomedical research. There are many that have been infected with diseases in the past, everything from HIV to hepatitis B, which they're never going to get rid of, and so they don't make ideal candidates to be placed in zoos or other kinds of facilities. But there are countries outside of the U.S. That continue to use great apes in biomedical research, and of course, those of us who work with great apes just think that's an immoral thing to do.
Then there are the stories of them as pets. Stanford points one out in the book that ended in misfortune for both the chimp and the couple who brought him into their home.
There's a long history, of course, of people keeping great apes as pets. I mean, in the old days, 50 years ago, it was legal to buy a chimpanzee from an animal dealer and raise it as your child in your home in America. And, of course, if you do that, you end up with a severely dysfunctional full-grown ape at some point, especially if we're talking about a male chimp who outgrows his home. He begins to become destructive. He just doesn't control his impulses very well. And in general, it's a bad scene for everyone. Of course, we've all seen these tragedies in recent years. The woman in Connecticut who was attacked by a pet chimpanzee. You know, just a bad idea to have any wild animal being kept in your home as a pet and thinking that that animal is no longer wild. In the case of great apes, it's doubly tragic because the animals themselves are highly intelligent, psychologically very needy, emotionally needy creatures that are really a person in a household cannot possibly care for, no matter how much they think they might be able to. It's largely illegal to obtain a baby ape today in the United States. There are cases. There's a case going on in Las Vegas right now where someone wants to have, I think, not one but multiple pet chimps. But in general, it's much more difficult to do that than it ever has been. But, you know, there are many ethical questions being raised, even about whether chimpanzees and other great apes belong in zoos, because most zoos are not big enough and wealthy enough to be able to really build a facility that is spacious enough and enriching enough for these animals. We put them in enclosures, and even though their cognitive abilities overlap with that of our own, of course, we put them in enclosures we would never consider putting a human being into. So there are a lot of thorny ethical questions involving great apes that I think as time goes on, as the 21st century goes on, we're realizing that they just do not make appropriate captive animals in any context.
The great ape populations are declining, while the threats to them are mounting. Their survival appears impossible, but Stanford offers hope.
Well, I really do think that we're going through a bottleneck right now, just as North America went through a bottleneck in the 1800s, where we nearly lost a lot of our big animals, the bison, the wolf, and so forth, and we managed to just get through with enough of those animals to repopulate national park areas and sanctuaries. So today we have you know, relatively healthy populations of some of those big species. I'd like to think that great apes are in the same situation, and what we really need to do is ensure that over the next 50 to 100 years, that Africa and Asia develop in a way that leaves room for some populations of wild great apes in truly wild areas that are well protected. And I really do think that's possible. It all has to do with economic development in Africa and Asia and changing attitudes toward wildlife. And what people can do, what listeners can do, they can be aware and they can raise consciousness of other people. There are many organizations out there that money can be donated to, the African Wildlife Foundation, the Jane Goodall Institute. And I often tell young people that, you know, you don't need a PhD to get involved in conservation work. If you can afford to volunteer your time, you can get involved in conservation work here in the U.S., but even in developing countries where primates, including apes, live, and be part of grassroots movements.
And do you have any upcoming plans or projects?
A lot of my work these days involves my graduate students who are doing work in Africa on chimpanzee research topics. Some of those are pure research, trying to understand what these animals are all about still. I have students who are doing very conservation-oriented work, trying to understand, for instance, how forest fragmentation, deforestation affects chimpanzees, which often continue to live in areas that are now largely farmland, and they come into conflict with people, and try to understand how does this affect their society, what's the interaction between people and chimps. So I'm involved in all of these projects, and I'm also involved in conservation efforts with a whole range of other kinds of animals that are not great apes.
And what organizations do you recommend listeners to look to in order to try and get involved somehow?
I always recommend people get involved with and try to follow the activities of the Jane Goodall Institute, JGI. I mean, Jane Goodall is, as everybody knows, I think, still a very active force in the conservation world. She's become something of a Mother Teresa for the global environmental issues that are going on in the 21st century. And she has a nonprofit institute that is a very worthy cause for people to be following and to be donating to. There are many others. There are grassroots organizations all across Africa. The African Wildlife Foundation is a good one that people can find easily on the Internet and donate to.
That was primatologist Craig Stanford, author of Planet Without Apes. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Elaine Taylor, and Susie Montgomery. Thank you for listening.